Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Ben Franklin Technology Partners has provided both early stage and established companies with funding, business, and technical expertise and access to a network of innovative expert resources. Now, that comes from the website. Funding comes from the state. And that funding has been cut in half over the past decade or so. We'll talk more about economic development and job creation through the program on today's show. Why should state funding continue? Joining us on the program is Ryan Glenn, Director of Statewide Initiatives at Ben Franklin Technology Partners. Mr. Glenn, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks for having us.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. There probably are a lot of Pennsylvanians who haven't come into contact with Ben Franklin Technology Partners. Define or explain what it is.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. So Ben Franklin is a program that was actually initiated by the state government back in the early 1980s. And our structure is that we're a network of four independent nonprofit organizations that collectively cover all 67 counties in the state. And our primary mission is to encourage startup activity and entrepreneurial activity, particularly entrepreneurs and startups with a innovation or technology focus throughout the state. And we do that through a series of programs. Our primary program is to actually invest in the startup companies themselves, and then we surround them with a lot of support services, such as management consulting, or provide them with networks or access to networks that can be beneficial to help them grow.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned primarily technology. Ben Franklin Technology Partners, the word technology didn't used to be in the title, correct?
Yeah, actually, when we were first founded, as I believe it was called the Advanced Technology Centers of Pennsylvania, and we had a different focus in the 1980s. We were primarily focused on supporting research projects that were coming out of some of Pennsylvania's major research universities. And through a series of iterations over the last several decades, we've transformed into what we are today, which has a much more, is actually primarily or almost entirely focused on the entrepreneurs themselves.
Mm-hmm. You know, a bit of history. You talked about starting up in the 80s. There may be people who would ask, is this the job of state government? I mean, what was the purpose behind this? What was the thinking of what, let's establish this organization, this agency, to help entrepreneurs out there get started?
Yeah, that's a great question, Scott. And when Ben Franklin was, when the program was originally founded, Pennsylvania was going through some real challenges with unemployment, as well as challenges with our prime economy, which was industrial in nature. And at the time, the statewide unemployment was approaching 15%, and it was nearly or above 25% in the Pittsburgh region. And the legislature and Governor Thornburgh at the time had the foresight to see that we really needed to do something to change the makeup of our economy and to invest in companies, technologies, and innovation that were going to be providing the jobs of the future, really, provide that economic growth that can be sustainable to the future instead of just relying on our existing industrial base.
It's hard to believe for people who didn't live through that period, 15% unemployment in the early 80s. I mean, we all think of the Great Recession in 2008, 2009, but the early 80s was a very challenging time, not just for Pennsylvania, but the entire country. But Pennsylvania was especially hard hit.
Absolutely. That's definitely correct. And at the time, there was some really interesting things that were developing on the coast. So we saw some innovative activity that was having success. It's when we really started to see the venture capital industry take hold in San Francisco and Silicon Valley. And Pennsylvania looked at that and saw an opportunity to create that same kind of momentum and that same kind of investment activity here in Pennsylvania, which could benefit Pennsylvania citizens.
And there are places in Pennsylvania, you mentioned Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh has reinvented itself as a technology hub, looked at as a national leader in that area, in King of Prussia, the Philadelphia area, actually throughout the state. So things have changed over the years. But let's get back to exactly what Ben Franklin does. When you say invest and help in consulting, invest in what?
Yeah, so we are actually investing in for-profit businesses. We're helping entrepreneurs at their earliest and their most vulnerable stages. And this could be anything from a researcher or a grad student at a university who has a novel concept for a new medical device that might come out, and we would invest in them to help them establish a company and then get them surrounded with people that can help them with business practices and actually grow a company out of that. Or it could be two guys and a dog in a garage, your proverbial startup, who are working on a novel application that makes sense and can grow. Our primary purpose is to invest in these companies and help them get to scale so that they can hire workers and create jobs for Pennsylvanians.
When you say come to scale, what do you mean by that?
So, in the earliest stages of a startup, often entrepreneurs are trying to utilize the resources as efficiently as possible. When they really start to scale, when they really start to generate revenue, is when they start to onboard more and more employees. When they approach the couple hundred thousand or the $1 million mark in revenue, and they really start to add employees that are going to support that revenue base.
Mm-hmm. When you said two guys and a dog in the garage, is there actually businesses that you've invested in that started that way?
I don't know that for sure.
Or is that just a metaphor?
That's a metaphor that's pretty common in the industry.
When you say invest, are you talking about grants or loans?
These are actual investments for return. So they are typically structured as loans, but they are extremely entrepreneur friendly, meaning that we try to do everything we can not to harm the entrepreneur. We're not like a traditional venture capital fund or even a bank whose primary purpose is financial return. We're looking to do everything we can to help that entrepreneur grow a company. And so while we do expect a return on our money, and there's reasons for that, we often defer our payments or defer our interest or defer a lot of financial incentives in order to make sure the entrepreneur has the best chance of success.
Let's talk about that. Do you have, and we're going to talk about some statistics here in just a few minutes, mm-hmm. The track record of Ben Franklin Technology Partners. But when you look at a company that, and I imagine a startup is applying for these funds, for this investment, are there some that you have turned down because you don't feel that it is a wise investment? Are there some that you have invested in that have not been successful? And then, of course, the positive news is, what percentage of businesses or startups that you did invest in have had long-term, long lives?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'll start with the first one. Yeah, absolutely. We get applications or we get interest from entrepreneurs all the time, and they come from various directions. But there are definitely opportunities that we pass on because they're not viable for a number of reasons. Either, we can't get behind the business model, or we don't see the economic impact for Pennsylvania. It could be a great business model, but what we see is that it's not going to create the kind of jobs or the type of jobs that we're really looking to create. So we may turn down a company for different reasons. Or we may just turn them down because we just simply don't have the resources to invest in any additional startups during that time frame. In terms of the success rate, SBA has actually put out statistics that Business Administration, that approximately 50% of startups fail within the first 5 years. And when we looked at our success record or our track record over the last 10 years, recently, not over the most recent last 10 years, but recently, we saw that about 85% of our companies were still in business after 10 years. So that's a fantastic track record. Obviously, we have some that fail. That's going to be a natural part of the business. And we encourage entrepreneurs that aren't getting traction or aren't making progress to either pivot or to find something else. I mean, if you can't make the business model work, it's better to get out and try something else than it is to continue to pour resources into something that's not going anywhere.
What's the priority? You mentioned some of the questions that are asked. You want to create jobs. Obviously, you want to create some tax revenue for the Commonwealth, but is there a priority?
I mean, our priority is to our priority is focused on the entrepreneur. It is to see the employers of the future in the industries of the future have the best chance to grow in Pennsylvania. And we're seeing this across the board, where Pennsylvania is increasingly in a competition for the best technology, the best innovation, the best talent. The Amazon HQ2 process is an example of that. And we try to do everything we can to create an ecosystem here in Pennsylvania that is fertile and is attractive for those types of entrepreneurs. It's almost like investing in your future, and that's definitely our priority. What happens after that is really the benefits that come from focusing on that priority. It is increased jobs for Pennsylvanians. It is new technology that helps Pennsylvania citizens and global citizens, for that matter. And it's also additional tax revenue for the state.
Mm-hmm. What's hot right now? When you talk about technology, entrepreneurship, startups, what's hot right now?
Yeah, there's a lot of industries that are hot right now. We try not to chase necessarily what's hot, but really evaluate whether or not we see it as having traction. But some of the areas that are getting increased attention are certainly robotics and artificial intelligence. And we have an incredible strength in that in the Pittsburgh region. We have a lot of technology and information coming out of Carnegie Mellon. And Uber and Facebook and Google have all set up shops in that area because of some of the strength that's demonstrated there in robotics and artificial intelligence. Some other areas are blockchain technology and what that can do in terms of transactions and privacy. I don't actually pretend to understand blockchain, but I do know that it's getting a lot of attention. Some of the other traditional areas that are hot are always hot are the medical devices. We see a lot of that activity in the Philadelphia and the Northeast region of Pennsylvania.
You mentioned Amazon when they were looking for a second headquarters, location for a second headquarters, and everyone, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, even central Pennsylvania here, put in a bid for that or at least a proposal. Was Ben Franklin involved in that at all? And what can we learn from, okay, for example, Pennsylvania was unsuccessful, then went to other locations. Was Ben Franklin involved in that? And what can we learn from it?
When you say involved, we were certainly supportive of the applications. And obviously, if we see, you know, a major technology behemoth like that come, it's a nice signal that we in Pennsylvania are doing the right things. It means that we're creating the kind of talent, we're creating the kind of innovations that are attractive to a technology company like that. And I think the fact that we had two cities still on the list at the very end is a testament to the fact that the work that Ben Franklin has been doing for the last 35 years is having an impact. We are creating some of that activity. We didn't lead any of those applications.
Yeah, I mean, I asked that question with the knowledge that Amazon isn't exactly a startup entrepreneur.
Yeah. Yeah, I think what we can learn from what Amazon ended up deciding is that what's really important in terms of development activity is to continue to develop the innovation and the talent that you have in your own backyard.
That the state would have for future entrepreneurs coming in.
Absolutely. Because when you invest in your own people and in your own technologies, that is attractive to outside companies as well. And I think that's why you see Amazon choosing a place like Washington, D.C. and like New York, because they saw the existing talent and the innovation and a pool that they could pull from for their own purposes.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. The next Smart Talk road trip is tomorrow at the Phillips Museum at Franklin and Marshall College in Lancaster. Joining us for the live broadcast from 9 to 10 a.m. as I speak with the artist behind the museum's new Hostile Terrain exhibit, a multimedia installation focused on migration and border crossing between Mexico and the United States. You can RSVP at WITF.org/events. That is tomorrow between 9 and 10 here on WITF. ETF. I'd like to see you out there. If you're tuning in right now, we're talking about the Ben Franklin Technology Partners with Ryan Glenn, Director of Statewide Initiatives at Ben Franklin, talking about exactly what Ben Franklin does, technology in Pennsylvania, economic development. We're going to have some numbers here in just a few minutes. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can also leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Mr. Glenn, I want to get into some numbers here. There was a report just released by the Pennsylvania Economy League, and is it pronounced Kleos Consulting, said that Ben Franklin Partners created 11,407 jobs, generated $386 million in tax receipts for the state, and boosted the state's economy by $4.1 billion between 2012 and 2016. I guess the big question there is, how was that done?
Yeah, great question, Scott. We're super proud of that report for obvious reasons. And the way that report came about is that we commissioned the Pennsylvania Economy League to take an independent look at the companies that we were investing in, and then actually compare them to a control group of companies that Ben Franklin had not invested in, and compare the performance to see what impact Ben Franklin really does have on the companies that we invest in and support. And their data obviously shows that Ben Franklin has a pretty dramatic impact on the companies that we support, including the metrics that you just mentioned there. So in their comparison, they're showing that we're creating essentially 11,000 more jobs through the investments that we're making in those companies than otherwise would have been there had we not been able to invest in those companies.
Mm-hmm. And these are good-paying jobs. Average salary of what?
Average salary approaching $80,000, which is approximately 50% more than the average non-farm wage in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm. We have a call here from George in Dillsburg, who has one of the big questions of the day. George, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Scott. Thank you for today's program. And Ryan, I just had a chance to visit the Technology Accelerator in Carlisle last year and was just so impressed by the work that they're doing there. And it seems like here we don't have a lot of venture capitalists, and what you're doing is creating the kind of jobs that we desperately need in South Central Pennsylvania. So I'm just curious, why do you think the state funding has gone down when it seems you're really trying to lead us directly where we need to go in the future?
Hey, George, thank you very much for your question. And just to provide some context to that, as I said, that was one of the big questions on today's program. The funding from the state has been cut in half from $28 million about 12 years ago. It was actually still during the Rendell administration. And today, $14 million. So after all those numbers that I just listed, that would seem to show that there is some success out there, why cut it in half?
Yeah, I think the answer there is, and I don't want to speculate for what a legislator is thinking, but I think what happened there is that when faced with a dramatic drop in revenue, the state had to make cuts somewhere, and unfortunately, the discretionary dollars are where they see the opportunity to cut that. We've gotten feedback every year, fantastic feedback, that legislators, representatives, and the administration wholeheartedly believe in the program. And the challenge that we run into is they just feel like they don't have adequate resources in order to carve out the necessary funding to continue to fund the program at the historical levels. Unfortunately, it's not necessarily a belief that the program's not working. It's just a challenge that they have other priorities, and investing in our future, unfortunately, isn't one of them.
Well, let's talk about that, because as I'm sure you're aware, there's a school of thought that economic development dollars are not well spent. You said that these are discretionary dollars. Meaning that someone has to look at it and say, well, a choice has to be made of whether this is something the state really needs. When you're talking $14 million from the state, but $386 million coming back in tax revenues, that would seem to be a pretty good bet.
Yeah, that's our position as well. We feel like the return on investment is pretty solid for the state. That same independent analysis that you referred to before from the Pennsylvania Economy actually showed that the state receives approximately $3.90 back in additional state tax revenue for every dollar that it invests in the program. I don't know about you, but that's the return that I would like to get on my kind of money.
Okay, now I don't want to make it sound like I'm a cheerleader for you or anything else, but I'll ask that question again about the school of thought that economic development dollars are not well spent. I have heard legislators say that we're not getting a good return on our money when we're throwing dollars at economic development. Now, a lot of times, I think what they're talking about has to do with tax cuts, tax incentives, and huge proposals like Amazon.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that's the case, and sometimes programs that are producing good results get lumped in with some of those other programs. As you mentioned, companies that take advantage of the tax incentives to set up shop, and they maybe don't fulfill their promises in terms of jobs or revenue or state tax revenue that they're putting back into the state. I believe that the Auditor General actually came out with a report recently that showed that a number of companies that received incentives weren't living up to their expectations, and that's been cracked down on a decent amount. So I can see where the school of thought comes from, and unfortunately, programs like Ben Franklin get lumped into those overall economic development programs in that viewpoint.
The $14 million that you get from the state, and that's on an annual basis, the $14 million that you get, how much of that goes toward investment into small businesses, entrepreneurs?
Yeah, great question. And actually, more than $14 million goes into entrepreneurs every year. We invest in typically between 140 and 160 companies a year. And that our total investment statewide approaches around $20 million. And so we're actually investing more than what we get from the state in companies. And that additional revenue or that additional investment comes from other sources, like the returns that we get from previous investments or from other programs, either at the federal or state level, where we can access some dollars to put into companies.
Well, that was my next question. It was a math question. If you're getting $14 million from the state, how are you investing $20 million?
Yeah, so we are specifically encouraged and charged with getting a return for our investment, and then using that return to continue to further the mission of Ben Franklin. And so, in addition to the $14 million that we get from the state, we use the returns we get from investments we've made before. That's some of the money that gets used. In addition, we try to leverage our state dollars as much as possible by getting federal grants or setting up co-investment programs with, say, a local county who might want to invest in some startups in their area. And so we try to maximize our state dollars by multiplying them through returns and other grant programs that we can access.
So $14 million from the state. What's your total budget for on a yearly basis?
Statewide, and it's gone down here, obviously, over the years. But statewide, it's just under $40 million.
Mm-hmm. So that cut by 50% from the state, what has that done? What has been the result of that?
Yeah, the result of that has been that we've had to be more cautious and more selective with the investment that we've made. Certainly, there are companies out there that we probably would have wanted to invest in, and I honestly can't name any of those, but that we would have wanted to invest in, but for not having additional resources. In addition, the real harm is in the support services that we have to cut back on. We, as I said before, we try not to harm the entrepreneurs, and so we try to maintain our level of investment as best we can. But there are other areas where we might have to cut back, and that could be in the area of consulting with the companies and providing them with support services, or supporting other ecosystem building activities, like supporting additional accelerators or other incubators in the regions that we're in order to continue to encourage additional startup activity.
What comes under the heading of consulting? Because, I mean, that's one of those things that a lot of people can say they're consultants, but what comes under consulting?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we do it in different ways in different places. But really what we're doing is we're walking side by side with an entrepreneur to help them with disciplines that they're just not going to be familiar with. And, those disciplines could be as simple as, accounting, setting up your accounting software in order to track, the financials of your company. It could be an HR consultant that helps you to recruit the right kind of employee or talent that you need to succeed. It could be marketing help. It could be, you know, we bring a professional in marketing alongside an entrepreneur, you know, just to get the word out and help them spread the word and grow their company. So we really surround the entrepreneur with everything that we can and that they might not have an expertise in to help them succeed. And often our entrepreneurs come back and say that consulting and that support service was as important, if not more important, than the investment dollars.
You mentioned earlier, and I think it was a figure from the Small Business Administration, that half of startups fail within the first 5 years. You also mentioned that 85% of yours are still running after 10 years. So it must have a solid base. Why does a business fail? I mean, I know you can't look at, there's not a blanket statement, but what are some of the reasons that a startup doesn't make it, isn't successful?
Sure. You know, a couple of those reasons might be that they just don't have a product market fit. You know, they think they have a product that the market needs, but when they go to market, nobody's willing to pay for it, or they're just not willing to buy it. And so, you know, obviously that's a reason why you would fail. Another reason is that unfortunately we do see this in cases where an entrepreneurial team, a co-founding team, just doesn't get along, or they can't see eye to eye, and often that creates problems and challenges in the company. That could be another reason that the company fails. In our case, a lot of times companies could fail just because they run out of money. They need an extra runway to be able to continue to deliver the product to the market and get to a scale where they become profitable. And we can only invest so far, and then we need private capital to come in and help the companies as well.
When you say invest so far, is there a percentage that is like your top line, that this is, you know, here's how much we can invest, you're going to need this much more to on top of it?
Yeah, we certainly don't cut it off at any specific, you know, standard number, and it's really a company by company basis. But frequently, and in the regions, it varies as well. But we often don't invest or can't invest more than a couple hundred thousand dollars into a company. And then we really need the private market to take it over.
What do you think, and I hate for you to, like, or maybe I shouldn't say I hate, but you may not want to do this, but give us some success stories. Some of the companies that you would look at and say, this was, you know, a company or an industry that really took off after they worked with you, Ben Franklin Technology Partners.
Yeah, I'll give you a couple, just a couple examples off the top of my head that I think are representative of some of the things we invest in. In the Pittsburgh region, we invested in a company called Four Moms, and we were one of the first institutional investors in that company back when they were first starting in the mid-2000s. Four Moms makes really innovative technology-based products for the baby market. So they make technology-enabled cribs, playpens, feeding seats and strollers and et cetera. And they really took off. And they're actually manufacturing the product in Pittsburgh as well, and grew very quickly from, you know, a handful of employees to right now, I think the last number I heard is that they're in the 70 to 80 employee range. So great success story. Now have, you know, multiple tens of millions of dollars in revenue and are doing great things, both for the baby market as well as for employees in the Pittsburgh area.
Mm-hmm. You know, they're... I don't have to tell you, but just want to ask the question that there is a lot of competition amongst states. Pennsylvania constantly is competing with other states for jobs, for industries, for Amazon is maybe the perfect example. But does Ben Franklin offer Pennsylvania a competitive edge with its neighbors?
I certainly think it does. And the Ben Franklin program is often referred to as the gold standard in this type of economic development activity. We're very frequently referenced by other states, even other nations, who are looking at this program and looking to model it for their own purposes. And so we certainly provide a competitive edge against, you know, our neighbor states who are either just starting this activity or who aren't, you know, haven't quite built the ecosystems that we have. Unfortunately, they're catching up, and they're investing heavily into this type of activity at a time where, you know, we tend to be cutting back.
What is Pennsylvania's competitive edge? Go ahead. I know you're not going out probably like the governor and other people in DCED, Department of Community Economic Development, but if you were talking to someone about a startup here in Pennsylvania as compared to another state, what would that be?
Well, I think we offer some incredible advantages to startups here. One, we are naturally an innovative people, and we're an industrial people. We're hardworking, and so we bring a lot of ingenuity to the problems that we're seeing. In addition, I think we have a very collaborative environment where we're willing to share ideas, we're willing to work together to solve problems and get things done.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank Ryan Glenn, Director of Statewide Initiatives at Ben Franklin Technology Partners, for being with us. Mr. Glenn, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. 25-year-old Air Force Staff Sergeant Dylan Elchin of Beaver County in western Pennsylvania was killed in Afghanistan last November. Fortunately, we don't hear about casualties from America's longest war as often anymore. But news of the death of a service man or woman today is a shock. But it also reminds many Americans that fighting is still going on in Afghanistan, something we don't hear about every day. Staff Sergeant Elchin is being buried at Arlington National Cemetery in Virginia today. PA Post reporter Ed Mahan visited with his family and joins us on Smart Talk. Ed, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So tell me a little bit about Dylan Elchin.
He was somebody who, when he was about 14 or 15, got really interested in special forces and the military. And the way his family tells it, he spent years then preparing to join the special forces. He was a former Boy Scout. He was confident. He was a jokester in his family. And then right after high school, he enlisted in the Special Forces. And then he spent years preparing to go overseas.
You had an opportunity to speak with members of the family. And here's something that his grandfather, Ron Begolia, had to say about Dylan.
If you ask him, he would give you the shirt off his back. And then he'd button it up for you, you know. He was very, very good-hearted, very loving. I mean, the last time he was here, you know, every time it was big hug, I love you, Pap. Mm-hmm. You know, it was not, and he did that all his life.
So it sounds as if, as you said, that he not only was a jokester, was someone that had a great personality in his family, but also sound like someone who was very giving and that was liked by many people.
That's very true. And, you know, I think I talked to his middle school principal, his former middle school principal, and she had similar things to say about, you know, the sort of just the kindness of him. And then I talked to, you know, people who had served with him, and he was the kind of person you wanted to serve with. He was just happy to just do. I talked to one of his superiors, talked about how he's happy to just, you give him the worst job, he would just do it with a smile on his face, come back, say, I crushed this, what else do you got for me?
Mm. Why did you travel to Beaver County to learn more about Dylan Elchin?
You know, we heard about his death in late November, and I think as you said in the intro, we don't hear about these deaths as much anymore, but there are still people overseas risking their lives. And we were interested in talking to his family, talking to his friends, talking to people in the community about who he was, what the impact of his death is, and, you know, what they think about the fact that the war has gone on for so long. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we found out later, after it was announced that he had died, and then days later, another service member from Pennsylvania died. Sergeant Jason McClary, he died from injuries from the same attack.
That's Export, Pennsylvania, also in western Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned this, but who did you talk with when you were in Beaver County?
So first person I talked to was his former middle school principal, Carrie Rowe. She's now the superintendent in Beaver Area School District, which is where he went to school for most of his life up until senior year. I talked to a classmate of his from middle school, high school. And then I spent some time with his grandfather, his grandmother, Sandy, who you heard on that recording. And the grandfather was almost like a father figure to him in many ways. And then while I was at their house, one of the brothers stopped by, Ryan. And the next day I spent some time with members of the military community just to get a sense of, you know, how this was impacting the entire community there. And then, you know, some additional phone calls with someone he served with another brother as well.
You mentioned that he seemed to have this dream of joining the military very early on in his life, and not just joining the military, but Special Forces, in which he was a member of Special Forces. Did his family know why that was something that he aspired to?
You know, it was interesting. I talked to him about it because, you know, his grandfather was served in the Vietnam War era. I think he enlisted just before he was about to be drafted. His older brother was in the Pennsylvania Army National Guard. But both of them pointed to this passion as his own. I mean, his brother said that he was much more – that Dylan was much more gung-ho about it than he was. And his grandfather sort of just, you know, downplayed his own military service. I think, you know, people talked about – I think he was very – one of the things his grandfather talked about was just his ability to just, from a very young age, to just push himself harder and harder in ways that would – you wouldn't normally expect from most people. So I think that, you know, I think that was part of it, just the challenge. I think also the service. I mean, I think, you know, what his brother has talked about, the Boy Scouts as being sort of an important factor, just the rituals of the Boy Scouts, but also the sense of duty and obligation of the Boy Scouts. And then as he got older, I think, you know, he sort of, his brother said he believed in the mission and what he was doing over there.
So what exactly was he trained to do?
So he went. He became a combat controller. So this is in the Air Force. These are the people who are trained to serve on the ground with other special forces. He was with Green Beret. Two Green Berets were with him when he was killed. And he's the guy who, if there's a firefight, he'll look at the enemy's position and then call in air support to assist, you know, the troops on the ground. So, you know, he's an airman, but he's on the ground.
But he knew, and it appears from the conversation you had with members of his family, that they knew that he could be in danger.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And so, and was it, I mean, one of the stories his grandfather told, which was his grandfather sort of laughed when he told it, but when he first enlisted, the grandfather said, you know, Ron told him, you know, go and do something practical. Go be an air traffic controller or something like that, and that way you can, you know, work in that field when you're out of the military. And so then he told his grandfather, "I am an air traffic controller," but it wasn't the way his grandfather originally pictured. I think his grandfather found it out, you know, as he was going through some of this more intense training.
So he was deployed to Afghanistan. What happened when Dylan went over to Afghanistan?
So he deployed in August. He visited Beaver County one more time in July to visit his family before deploying. Then he went over in August. And, you know, I think, you know, what he was doing over there is, you know, how shows sort of how the Afghanistan war has changed. He was sort of providing support to Afghanistan forces on the ground. And then, you know, he's over there for a few months. I mean, I think his grandfather talked about some of the danger he had been in previously. And then in November, just a little bit after Thanksgiving, he had like his final video call with his family. I think.
Brian. And let's bring it in here because let's go back to Dylan Elchin's grandfather, Ron Begolia. And Ron talks about the conversation that he had with Dylan the week before he was killed.
And never thought in a million years that 2 days later he'd be dead. And the day my daughter got the notification, she answered the door, and Dylan had told her, if they show up in civilian clothes, don't worry, I'm just hurt. But if they show up in uniforms, it's bad. And they showed up in uniforms.
So, I mean, that's always a heartbreaking scene to even picture. Yeah. Don't know what any parent would go through when they see those servicemen or women standing on the porch in uniforms. So what happened? How was Dylan Elchin killed last November?
He was in Ghazni province. They were in a convoy, is how it was described in reports. And then a roadside bomb struck the vehicle he was in, pushed it into the air, and then it collapsed. And then he and two other service members were killed, I think, instantly in the attack. And then another soldier, a fourth soldier, Jason McClary, the other one from Pennsylvania, he was injured in the attack. And then days later, he died while being treated in Germany.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether you can answer this or not, but had Dylan been in any action before November 27th of last year?
Yeah, his grandfather described action, and then he had won several military members for some of the action he had been in, including the Bronze Star.
So what kind of impact did Dylan Elchin's death have on the community in Beaver County?
You know, I talked to his principal, and she, she's the superintendent now, his former principal, it was kind of a reminder for her. I mean, there's one, just the loss and the loss of knowing of someone she knew and had been close to, years ago. The idea that that person was gone was sort of shocking to her, and it was still shocking when I was speaking with her. And for her, she talked about how it was, a reminder that her current students, this war has been going on for 17 years. They've never really they've never known a time of peace. And, she was, I think the she was hopeful that there could be someday that there would be a time of peace. And, that might sound naive is how she put it. But, it's sort of a reminder for her of that this war has gone on for so long. And then talked to other military members, and I talked to a woman in the Air Force when I was in Beaver County. She was somebody who's working to establish a memorial for service members killed in the global war on terror. And she talked with some of the and she talked about how some of the younger members of the Air Force and Air Force Reserves, it was they know the idea that they could when you join the military that this could happen, but it was sort of a harsh reminder of this reality.
And when you talk about the war in Afghanistan being America's longest war, just think about it to remind everyone, this started the month after the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks here in America, and it's been going on ever since. It is the longest war in the nation's history. And that is something that you spoke about with Dylan's family, including his brother Ryan.
For so long.
Yeah, I thought... It should have been over by now. I think, when did it start? Like 2000?
17 years ago.
So, yeah, it would have been like 9 or 8. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Can't believe yeah. It's still going on.
Well, the problem over there is there are no distinct battle lines. It's somewhat of a guerrilla war. Where
and that's the grandfather, Ron, that is weighing in after Ryan there. But what did the people of Beaver County have to say about the war in Afghanistan still going on 17 years later?
Yeah, it was interesting. I talked to his family about it, and Ryan sort of just like it was mind-boggling that this has been going on for so long. Ron, he sort of views it as, it's terrible that Dylan's gone, but, if we're not over there, if we're not containing terrorism over there, then it's going to happen over here. That was his view. It's going to happen at football games and malls and other places. I talked to another one of Dylan's brothers, Aaron, who had served in the military, and he was telling me that even before his brother's death, he had questioned really what good we can do over in Afghanistan at this point. But he, made the distinction that he thinks his brother, Dylan, had a clear idea of what he was doing, that he was educated about the issue, and that he didn't die in vain. That was the point that Aaron made, that he knew what he was doing and he knew why he was doing it and that he believed in the mission.
Do they see Dylan as a hero?
I think everybody I talked to over there sees him as a hero, they see him as a hero, and they view him with, his brother Ryan talked about just sort of the inner strength he had, that it's something that he doesn't really think that he has for himself, but he talked about how trying to use his brother and his brother's legacy as a model for what he can do.
Many times we look at this and, as I said in the introduction, we're shocked by news of the death of someone who is serving in Afghanistan. But for families, it's personal.
Yeah.
And this family,
spoke about that. I mean, they talked about almost like it's a dream that they expect to wake up and to see Dylan. I mean, I think for those of us who have never lost a loved one to a violent death like this, that it's hard to understand. Did you get that sense?
Yeah, and I talked to Ron. He talked about years ago, maybe 20 years ago or maybe longer, or that a poem he hadn't thought about in 20 years. There was a poem that his mother shared with him about, just around the corner, the idea that somewhat, death is nothing, that they're just around the corner, that they're always there. And he talked about how, you sort of, your mind plays tricks on you and you think like, oh, that could be him coming at the door at any minute now. And so for them, it was very raw. It was very, still getting their heads around the idea that he's gone, that he wasn't coming back from Afghanistan. I mean, he was supposed to be back this month, and he's being buried today. They delayed the burial so that members of his unit could be here as well.
Yeah, let's talk about that. He wanted to be buried at Arlington National Cemetery, and you're going to be there. Arlington National Cemetery, did he want to rest in peace there? And why was it delayed, if you would? Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so his unit was scheduled to come back in January. He was scheduled to be married, shortly after coming back. And before he went over, he filled out the paperwork talking about exactly what he wanted for if he should die. I mean, his grandfather told me that as a way of talking about how he knew the risks that he was getting into. And so, that's where he chose to be buried, and that was his, one of his final wishes. Another thing we talked about, just sort of the community. I talked to the principal and some friends and other military members, and there was a sense of just, this mind-boggling is that we're still over there. Nobody really, or at least the people I talked to, didn't see that as, when 9/11 happened, that this would be the result, that we'd still be having troops over there. And so, I talked to a Vietnam veteran out there, and he talked about how when 9/11 did happen, he just had this sense that, everything's different now, the world's changed forever, and he didn't really understand how it would be changed forever, but, the fact that we're still there for him is just a sign of one way that the world has changed.
Something, Ed, that it strikes me, an observation. Part of it is because the United States has been fighting in Afghanistan for so long. But another part of it is that there are so few families that have members in the military that I don't want to say it's forgotten, but you don't hear about it every day unless there's a casualty or an attack. And that has to grate on the families of these servicemen and women that sometimes, you said that his brother said that Dylan's death was not in vain. But they have to think about that there are so few Americans who are serving in the military in harm's way while the rest of the country life goes on.
Yeah, and I think that is one of the the struggles. And with some of the other military members I talked to, is they talked about how there is sort of a that difference is there, that for a lot of people it is pushed out of, for a lot of people it is just in the atmosphere, in the background, but it's not something that they're thinking about all the time, the risks that are happening. But for the family members, that risk is always there. And his family, they knew he was over there. They knew it was dangerous. But I think what they were saying is just how dangerous, and maybe they didn't. Maybe you can never really fully realize how dangerous it is until something happens. But
So Ed Mahan with PA Post, we just touched the surface of telling Dylan Elchin's story. If our listeners would want to read your story in PA Post, how can they do that?
PAPost.org. It's also on WITF.org. You can should be on the find it on the main homepage today. We've got photos too. One of the photos that his grandfather showed me was, there's a photo of him, and it's kind of striking. It's when he was maybe like 10 years old in a Boy Scout uniform, wearing a red beret, saluting to the camera. And then years later, he's wearing the red beret of the combat controller. It's unique to that that type of service in the Air Force. And so we've got other photos and other aspects of the story as well.
Mm. It's a sad story, a tragic story, but one that's a very compelling story as well. Ed Mahan, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, it's a Smart Talk road trip to the Phillips Museum at Franklin and Marshall College in Lancaster. If you'd like to attend the live broadcast at the Phillips Museum, go to WITF.org/events.